Good morning, folks, and this is Ed Lopez, of course, and I'm going to welcome you to our second asset development webinar in 2011, and this is part two of the Asset Development is Possible for Social Security Disability Insurance Recipients and SSI Income Recipients. This webinar will be conducted by me. I'll be the presenter. Ray Sabula was going to join me, but my friend Ray was stuck in Ithaca last night, couldn't get out because of the weather, and thus is right now probably boarding a plane in Ithaca to go through New York City and then go back to Boston. So it will just be me. As usual, I've got so many people to thank for making these webinars possible. First, let me thank my IT guru, Mike Ward. And Mike has gone, I can't tell you, beyond the call of duty over the past few weeks, making sure that these webinars work smoothly. I know that many of you were on the webinar last week when, unfortunately, our slides got stuck, etc. So Mike has been able to figure out some of the stuff that was going on. We are installing a new line in Rochester to make that possible. And right now I'm working from a 4G hotspot that Mike was able to get for me so that this does not happen again. So I am hoping this will go smoothly, but Mike, you are the man. So I've got to say. Secondly, I've got to thank Katie Steigerwald who prepares the slides, does all the registrations for us, and just keeps this program running smoothly. Thirdly, I want to thank Elizabeth Jennings from the Burton Blatt Institute of Syracuse University who actually presented these webinars last year. She and Michelle Rollins did four of them last year, and lo and behold, we've limited it to two this year. And let me just say to you as we get started that these webinars are not webinars to teach you how to teach financial planning. They are more strategy webinars. During last week's webinar, we talked about the importance of financial planning, and then we talked about some strategies and what we as benefits practitioners could do. But if we try to spend time teaching you how to do financial planning, it will be a 20-week course at an hour and a half a week because there is so much there. So this is more strategies. And the reason I mentioned this is that I had one person send me an email and say, gee, I expected to just find out, like, how do we do all this financial planning? And I said, are you kidding me? FDIC does a 10-week course on it. And this is not what this is about. This is more strategies to let you know what's out there so that individuals who are on SSDI or SSI can actually do some asset accumulation. So I wanted to just point that out for folks because, you know, it's really important. Again, these four webinars that Elizabeth Jennings and Michelle did last year are archived in our New York Makes Work Pay website under the resource tab. And there's the site there for you. And the ones that we're doing this year, both last week's and this week's, will be archived and ready to be posted sometime in about a month. So just want you to get that information. As always, there are different ways to log on and listen to the dulcet tones of Ed Lopez. And so of course, on the right-hand side of your computer, you will see a GoToWebinar control panel. And there are many tabs there. And one of the tabs is audio. And if you were to click on the audio mode, you will see a use telephone or use mic and speakers. And most of you will be using the use mic and speakers because you'll be on the computer. But some of you will not be able to listen on the computer. You'll have the slides up, but you'll have to listen by telephone. And those of you who do would have to click on the use telephone button, and up will pop up a dial-in number and access code and an audio PIN, not the ones that you see there, your very own. And then voila, you could hook on. Next, of course, once again, if you were to go to your GoToWebinar control panel, you will see a questions tab. And the reason I mentioned this to you is that I really appreciate questions during the presentation. They help move the agenda along. They break up the monotony of just listening to Ed Lopez yak on and on and on. And so if you've got questions, by all means put them down. Mike will be monitoring them, and if there's a question that seems right on point, he will interrupt and let me know. If he doesn't, it means that I can wait till breakpoints, and then I will handle those questions as they come up during breakpoints. Okay? So having said that, it is now time to get started. And today we're going to focus on the strategies for building financial stability. We're not going to teach you everything about them, because for example, last week we did Divida, and we also did family self-sufficiency. This week we're going to cover three big issues: the earned income tax credit, individual development accounts, and the plan for achieving self-support. And for those of you who say, oh gee, well, are we going to get into all the nitty-gritty? The answer is no. And why is that? Well, because, for example, the earned income tax credit materials, I have a webinar that goes for an hour and a half with all the rules, etc. It can't be done in 10, 15 minutes altogether. So I'm going to give you a snapshot, an overview of how it works, and then the effect that it will have on the different benefits out there. Secondly, individual development accounts. Same thing. We have a whole webinar on that. So I'll give you snapshots and how they are counted by the federal and state benefit programs. Then thirdly, the plan for achieving self-support. Well, listen, my friends, I actually do 6 webinars on the plan for achieving self-support during the year. It's a series that just progresses naturally through 6 whole webinars. It's not possible to just do it in 15 minutes, but I'll give you a snapshot of how it works so that folks understand that these are strategies that they can use as benefits practitioners to help an individual on SSI or on SSDI accumulate assets. So that's what we're going to be doing. So now we're going to get started right away with the earned income tax credit. And let me tell you, this is a very little known program. And amazingly enough, every year there are millions of dollars left on the table by individuals who do not file for the earned income tax credit who actually would qualify for it. And this was a provision that was basically enacted way back in 1975 as a provision. And then in 1978, it was made permanent. And let me good work incentive. Because if you look at the third bullet, you'll notice that there's a federal income tax credit for individuals who work and have earned income. See that? Individuals who work and have earned income. And in 2011, an individual with 2 qualifying kids and earning less than $41,952, or if they're married filing jointly, $47,162 can qualify. So that people who are making a fairly decent amount of money, whom one might categorize as firmly ensconced in the middle class, would qualify for the earned income tax credit. And what happens there? It basically results in a reduction of the tax amount owed, or sometimes a refund. So that's pretty incredible. And for people who are on SSI, it's an incredibly valuable program, because as you know, when SSI is and work is being calculated by the Social Security Administration, it's all gross income. And a lot of times a consumer will say, but why should I go to work? Because when they calculate my earnings, it's gross earnings. And really, the figures you say I'm getting are not true. And I always say, well, first of all, you're going to get back, given the earnings, all the federal all the state, and if you're in New York City, all the city taxes you paid for when you filed for your tax refund. But more importantly, people will then say to me, but not the FICA. And I can always say, you know what? Given your income, when you file your taxes, your earned income tax credit will basically be around the same as what you pay for FICA taxes. So it's an incredible, to me, an incredible program. And as it says here, it offsets a portion of the living expenses and the FICA contributions. And thus, it provides much needed support to the working poor and helping the working poor build assets. And at this point, I'm going to take you to our first polling question. And the first polling question reads as follows. Only an individual with a disability can qualify for the earned income tax credit. True or false? Only an individual with a disability can qualify for the earned income tax credit. And so far, we've got, in 20 seconds, we've got 70% of you having voted, and that's great. Absolutely great. And this question is being asked because there's a misperception out there about who's entitled to the earned income tax credit. A major misperception about it. We've got 80% of the vote in. Okay, so come on, a few more of you should vote, and then I will close the poll. Ah, good, we're up to almost 85% of the vote in. And today we've got over 50 participants, so it's great to have all of you on the call here. And hey, 90% of voters, I'm going to close the poll and I'm going to share the results. And the results say, who was it, McGovern? And who basically said he was 200% behind his vice presidential nominee, and then he dumped him. So anyway, it's 100%, and almost everybody got this right. Okay, the falses have it. Let me tell you, there is a misperception out there that only people who have a disability can apply for the earned income tax credit. But no, it's anyone. It's working poor build assets, and it so happens that individuals with disabilities often make up, as I showed you in a slide last week, a huge percentage of the working poor in our society. So again, great work there, folks. I'm going to hide the results and continue moving along. Now look at what the earned income and adjusted gross earned income levels are, because you know it tells you right away that it's not just for poor people. If you have three or more qualifying kids and you're married and you're filing jointly, $50,270. I've already covered the two qualifying kids, but look at the last item there. For married filing jointly, if you do not have a qualifying child, you can still have earnings of $19,190. $19,190, and that's a fairly decent sum of money. In addition to that, you may be asking yourselves, well, how much money can we get back? Well, if you have three qualifying children, you could get back up to $5,891. If you have no qualifying children, depending on your income, you could get back up to $475. And if you look at this slide here, and you look at the last line for more information, there's a publication put out by the IRS called IRS Publication 596. And you can actually at IRS and then look under publications and click on 596. And lo and behold, when you do that, immediately you can see right away these tables, And depending on what the person is earning, you can see how much and how many qualifying kids they have. You can see actually how much the credit will be for the year. Okay, so it's incredibly valuable. The last item I wanted to cover on this slide, of course, is the whole issue of investment income. And investment income basically means money that you are getting from your investments. It's not how much money you are investing, but money that you are getting from your investments. And that must be $3,200 or less for the year. So you can actually have some assets and still qualify for the earned income tax credit. So that's a very, very, very good thing, and you should keep that in mind. Always keep that in mind. Now, you may be wondering, but what are all these earned income tax credit requirements? And this is what I spend a whole webinar on. It's the requirements, but I go through them, of course, on a step-by-step basis. And here, I'm just going to give you a snapshot of what those requirements are. First, you must have a valid Social Security number. No valid Social Security number, no earned income tax credit. Simple as that. You know, that's like, you know, about as easy as it gets with that. The filing status cannot be married, filing separately. It's either married, filing jointly, okay, or single, but it cannot be married, filing separately. Next, the person must be a U.S. citizen or a resident alien all year, or a non-resident alien married to a U.S. citizen or a resident alien and filing a joint return. Okay, so again, the reason I've put that information up there is that we do have, of course, as you know, a lot of folks whom we work with who happen not to be U.S. citizens. And I want people to understand what's going on. And I hear someone just told me that it looks like we are going sometimes in and out, and Mike is, you know, monitoring that to make sure that we correct that right away. So someone just said, well, you just mentioned the $3,200 in investments, but if you're on SSI, and you're making up to $3,200 in investments, won't you have too many asset resources to keep your SSI? Well, that's absolutely correct. Okay, absolutely correct. But remember that that first polling question was about, it was about whether it was just for people with disabilities or many others. And this is to help the working poor too. And we may have a lot of folks with SSDI who might qualify, who would have some investment income coming in. So you're absolutely right. For SSI, you know, this would not be them. But for everybody else, of course, it would apply to them. So, but it's a great point you're making there. Absolutely great point. Next, if you do not have a qualifying child, okay, that means a single person, you must be either age 25, but under 65 at the end of the year. And it's not saying 65 in December 29th. Sorry. You have to be under 65 for more than half the year. And you cannot qualify as a dependent of another person. So that what that means is if somebody else can list that individual as a qualifying child, then they cannot apply for an earned income tax credit themselves. And that involves, of course, a lot of families, which we're talking about three generations. And so you cannot be the qualifying child of another person. And then this whole issue about cannot file form 2555, it's because that's foreign earned income. And if you've got foreign earned income and you didn't pay taxes in our states, then you're not going to qualify because it is an earned income tax credit for people who are working in the U.S. Okay? Simple as that, in the U.S. And now, my friends, I'm going to take us to the second polling question. And the second polling question is, you know, is a test, okay, to see how it works and how much you already know. And the question before I launch it is, if I get an earned income tax credit in my refund, it will count as income if I am on SSI, true or false. And I'm going to launch the poll and then let you respond to it. If I get an earned income tax credit in my refunds, it will count towards my SSI, true or false. And this is one to just see how much people know already and what's the perception out there. To me, these polling questions are very valuable because it says to me, okay, you can go through this pretty quickly because 97% of the people understand this. Or it'll say to me, gee, if more than 10% of the folks don't understand it, I've got to spend a little bit more time covering this material. Always, to me, a very, very, very important issue. So we've got in 44 seconds, we've got 81% of the vote in, and let's give you another 15 or 20 seconds, okay? Because to me, it's really important that folks get a chance to answer this so that I know the kind of detail I spend, on. So 1 minute, 8 seconds, and 85% of the vote, and I am going to close the poll, and I'm going to show you the results. The results say 18% said true. If I get an earned income tax credit in my refunds, it's going to affect my SSI, basically. And 'cause to me this is really, really, really important that you understand. These programs have been designed very, very carefully to help people who are poor accumulate asset. Okay? So you know that they're gonna be okay. And Mike, I hear you.
Yes, Ed. It looks like several people didn't hear that last answer.
Oh, okay, then let me thank you for telling me, Mike. Folks, I don't know what happened there. You know, you never know what's going on in the world of the internet and satellites, etc. But that last answer is false, okay? It's if I get an earned income tax credit in my refunds, it will affect my SSI. And the answer is false. And the reason it is false is because these programs are truly designed to help poor people accumulate assets. And so, and I'm going to cover now, if you guys don't mind, these programs fairly carefully. The receipt of the earned income tax credit and SSI. And look at this right away. SSA excludes all federal tax refunds and tax credits. And that includes the earned income tax credit from countable income. So it's not going to be considered income right off the bat. But secondly, in terms of resources, if the person gets a large earned income tax credit, only the unspent federal tax refund related to an earned income tax credit is excluded from resources for the 12 calendar months following the month the refund or payment is received. And that's great. It's excluded for 12 months. And more importantly is that these funds do not have to be held in a way that is separately identifiable to be excluded. Again, that is a truly positive thing here, a truly positive thing for individuals on SSI. And I'm going to tell you right now that I have never seen Social Security go after an individual who got an earned income tax credit because they had not spent their credit within, not back then, 9 months, and now within 12 months, okay? I have never seen them go after an individual, and that is a good thing. And of course, our folks are so poor that when they get the credit, oftentimes they've spent it by the time they get it. Okay, so I think, you know, it's not something that we have to worry about typically, but I want you to know what the rule is. Now, what about folks who are getting Medicaid? Because that is very important, right? Well, look at this here. Right off the bat, right from their MARG, the Medicaid Reference Guide, It says the following types of income are disregarded in the determination of gross monthly income for Medicaid: earned income tax credits. Disregarded. And we've given you, and this was prepared by Elizabeth Jennings, the citation and the page. She had looked it up for us, and that's great. Next, resources. The following is a list of resources that are disregarded for a limited time. And look at this, earned income tax credits. Okay, and they are exempt in the month received and the following month. So you notice they get treated differently in the SSI program and the Medicaid program, because for the SSI program, they're going to be disregarded for 12 months. In the Medicaid program, they're only disregarded in the month received and the following month. And so this is why I want to give you this information, because I don't want you to say to people, oh gee, but SSI, but then of course if the person's on SSI and they have Medicaid too, they need to know what would happen with their Medicaid at that point. Food stamps. Food stamps. Federal and state earned income tax credits paid in the form of a lump sum at the end of the year are excluded. And your slides had something about advance payments. And I took it out before doing the presentation today. And I'll tell you why. Because there's no longer going to be advance payments in 2011. All right? And so we don't have to worry about that anymore. In determining the resources of a household for food stamp purposes, for SNAP purposes, only the following shall be excluded: earned income tax credit refunds, as long as they remain identifiable. So you'll notice, once again, amazingly enough, we have a different set of rules here. Because for our purposes, they're going to have to have the monies that they get from an earned income tax credit, if they're not going to spend it pretty fast, okay, they're going to have to put that money into a separate account, okay, that's readily identifiable. So our Winters just wrote in and said, so wait a minute, someone with SSI and Medicaid could lose their Medicaid if they don't spend the earned income tax credit in basically under 2 months. Yes, our Winters, actually, it's not that they're going to lose it, because remember that it's going to count as a resource. And the beauty of resources and Medicaid is that for SSI purposes, the resource limit is $2,000, right? But for Medicaid purposes, the resource limit is $13,800. And so I don't think it's going to really adversely affect the person who's on Medicaid, because the resource limit is so much higher, especially if they're on SSI. I don't think it's going to adversely affect them, but I just want you to know what the rules are, just in case you've got folks who are also getting Medicaid, but they're not getting SSI. But that was an excellent question, okay? An excellent question. And you know, and this is why we have these sessions and why these questions are so helpful, because I would not have thought about talking about the differences and the resource limits between SSI and Medicaid unless our Winters had asked that question. And that is just an incredibly very smart question. How about HUD programs and the earned income tax credit? Because as you know, a lot of our consumers happen to be in subsidized housing. Well, earned income tax credits are excluded as income. But for resource purposes, listen to this, only the interest earned on earned income tax credit payments deposited into an interest-bearing account may count as income. So if you've got the money in an interest-bearing account and you're keeping it there, you're not spending it, lo and behold, the whole thing doesn't count as income, but any monies that you get when you get interest on it, the interest counts. Okay, and I don't expect that to have much of an effect at all on our clients, but I just want you to know what the rules are, just in case. Well, how about family assistance and the earned income tax credit? and they are in fact exempt as a resource or an income. And the regulations say whether received as a refund or an advance payment, but as you know now, there's no longer advance payments, but they have not changed their program, you know, materials, so it's still listed in there. And now we're going to go through polling. Oops, let me go back here for a minute. Go back to polling question number 3, my friends. And the polling question number 3 is as follows. IDAs are time-limited matched savings accounts. That's what it is, and I'm going to launch the poll. IDAs are time-limited matched accounts. And this is, again, we're going to be getting into the next topic, and I want to see how many people know what IDAs are right away. Okay, just to see how many people understand and know what IDAs are, and then we'll, you know, move on. And I see already we've got 60% of the people voting, and now this one has got many more folks, just so you know, many more folks who have are saying something different. So this is to me very, very interesting. IDAs are time-limited matched savings account. True or false? In 55 seconds, we've got 85% of you having voted with a 70-30 split. Whoa! Very, very interesting. I'm going to close the poll. I'm going to share the results. The results show 70% of you saying true and 30% saying false. And the answer is, in fact, true. But we're going to get to it in a minute. I wanted to say one last thing about the earned income tax credit that I've not mentioned yet. When an individual applies for the earned income tax credit, I showed you the amounts that they could get from the federal earned income tax credit. Because people live in New York, New York gives people an additional 30%. So if they're getting $600, okay, $600 from the feds as an earned income tax credit, an additional 30% or $180 comes in from the state also. And if they live in New York City, an additional 5%, so that would be $30 more, would come in from the city. Okay, and that's really important that everybody understand that. And now I'm going to hide the results, and I'm going to take us to our next slide here, which is on IDAs, Individual Development Accounts. And look at the first bullet right away. What is an IDA? It is a time-limited matched savings account. And I'm going to cover each one of these items. Time-limited. That basically means that the person is given X amount of time during which they must save Y up to Y amount of dollars per month. And then it will be matched by somebody else. And it could be matched by different amounts, and I will cover that in too much detail for you in a couple of minutes, okay? And what I say is too much detail for you in a couple of minutes. $2,000 per individual. Basically, they'll say, you know, a person might be asked to put in up to $2,000 per individual if it's a federal IDA. But you know, there's now a growing number of non-federal IDAs out there, individual development accounts. And they will have different limits, and they will be treated differently by the different federal programs. So I'm going to cover that in some detail for you. I'm going to tell you how federal IDAs are treated, and then I'm going to tell you how non-federal IDAs are treated. Every individual development account requires financial literacy training. And let me tell you, that's a good thing. Our individuals need to learn how to save money. And for those of you who want to see the ins and outs of credit cards and all that and how to treat them, etc., that's a good thing for you to go in and take a financial literacy training program. I think every one of us could benefit from a financial literacy training program. And if we get a grant that we have just put in recently, we will be conducting a 10-part or 12-part financial literacy training program for individuals with mental illness who have been getting SSDI and or SSI and also are thinking about going to work. There's got to be a targeted goal for the savings, okay? And there's limitations on that, and I'll cover that for you in a couple of minutes. And then they're going to be managed either through a bank, through a faith-based organization that's getting federal money, or a state entity, a credit union, or someone else that's listed if it is a non-federal individual development. An idea. Well, $1 of savings, right? $1 of savings could get you matched dollars of 50 cents so that your $1 becomes $1.50, or it could get you as much as $8 matched by a private or public institution. And that means $1 could get you $9. And that's incredible. There was one IDA recently in Ithaca that had an 8-to-1. And this was, you know, about a year and a half ago when they were also doing the credit for real estate for buying a home. And one of the purposes for this huge matching IDA was to help people put down a deposit on a first home so they could also get the tax credit. So that was an amazing IDA. I mean, they created an IDA in Ithaca to help people buying first-time homes to have enough money to put in a down payment. That was an amazing IDA. So it could be as little as 50 cent match, which is still a lot, or an $8 match. The IDAs, as I said to you, can be managed by community organizations, and the accounts are held at local financial institutions. And again, the participation is going to include literacy training to improve credit, the creation of a budget, and the savings schedule, right? Because you need a budget that says, here's when I'm going to be putting the money in for the IDA, and here's my savings schedule. And then it's also going to include the long-term management skills. So as part of that literacy training, it includes the components necessary to meet all those requirements out there. And again, that to me is a very good thing. Now let's look at the eligibility and uses. Well, to be eligible for an IDA, you've got to be at or below 200% of the poverty level. Okay? That's number one. Households may not have a net worth in excess of $10,000, but that excludes what is, to me, the biggie, two net worth items, which are, for most people, their primary residence and one vehicle. Both primary residence and one vehicle. That excludes that. Federal IDAs have a limit, they limit the use to home ownership, to post-secondary education, and to small business startups, okay? And by federal IDAs, I mean IDAs that are established by the Temporary Assistance to Needy Family Programs or the Assets for Independence Act. Now, for private or state IDAs, they can be used for home repair, for vehicle ownership, or sometimes for other reasons also. It all depends on who is creating the IDA. But I mentioned this one item to you about the federal versus other IDAs, so you see that they're treated extremely differently, okay, and that the uses are very different. If it's a federal IDA, and that's the most common, the use is limited to home ownership, post-secondary education, and a small business startup. Working people with disabilities who are eligible for SSI and SSDI are participating, I've got to be honest with you, in IDAs in a very small numbers, very small numbers. But if you look at the data over the last 3 years, those numbers are actually growing. And there is more participation now being made by individuals who are on SSI and SSDI, basically because we're doing a lot more proselytizing about it. We are talking about it. BBI is talking about it. You guys come to these sessions and you go back and you talk about it. And that is, you know, word of mouth is really important in these programs. Just like I said to you, that earned income tax credits are a best kept secret, IDAs often are too. And if people don't know about them ahead of time, when they show up, they go very fast. And so our consumers who are on SSI and SSDI often don't have much access to, you know, folks out there at credit unions, etc., and they have to depend on hearing about it through their faith-based organizations sometimes, or through training sessions put on by places like BBI or the local advocacy centers, etc. So again, we want to spread the word, and you can look up IDAs by going to the web and putting in individual development account, and then putting in on next to that Ithaca, New York, individual development account, Rochester, New York, wherever you are. And that makes a very big difference. Okay, now R. Winters just says, but someone on SSI who wants to do this has to be working. Absolutely. It's for people who are working, who are going to be putting money in, because a person who's on SSI really cannot put any money in of their SSI, because they basically, it's almost impossible to meet their living needs just on SSI. So absolutely correct, they've got to be working. But that's the whole deal behind this. Remember what our program is called? New York Makes Work Pay. This is all about work. It's about financial stability. It's to help a person who's on SSI work. There's no reason for a person on SSI, okay, to not work. Okay, just because a person has a disability, it does not mean that they cannot typically work. What typically happens with our consumers is that they want to work, but they either can't get a job, or more importantly, they're afraid to get a job because they worry about their health care benefit. And as everybody here knows, if a person loses their eligibility to cash benefit because of earned income, they can still keep 1619B and make up to $46,000. So they have nothing to worry about. But people don't know that. So it's up to us to explain that to the people that we work with, to individuals with disabilities. Now let's look at the activities. Well, look, individuals will be creating a personal savings plan. They're going to be establishing an IDA account. They're going to be taking money management courses. They're going to be either saving at or above the monthly targets, up to the maximum. And then they're going to be meeting their asset goals. And that's when you say to a consumer of yours, look at what the activities are and look at the end result, meet asset goals. Just think about it. The pleasure that it must bring someone who's working to actually be able to say, like they did in Ithaca, I just saved $1,000. It was matched by 8 to 1, that's $8,000 more. I have $9,000 to pay towards a down payment on a first home. And by the way, back then, I'm going to also be getting a credit of $8,000 to my taxes because of this. Oh my God, that's incredible. Absolutely amazing. And, you know, we have people who would call and they'd be crying because they just got into the program. So absolutely amazing program. But of course, there's going to be program variations, and I've mentioned this to you, but I want to make sure that everybody here understands that when you look at an IDA, you've got to see what the criteria are. For example, the target population might be different. It could be for folks on SSI. It could be for folks on TANF, family assistance. It could be for folks who are working and doing, you know, and want to do something else. Or the program requirements could be different, okay, in terms of how many sessions do you have to take for literacy training. Or there could be a minimum investment. Look, you know, you've got to be able to put in at least $500 during the year. There could be a maximum or minimum amount saved each month. They could say, we expect you to put in $50, $100 each and every month for 2 years, or for 16 months, or for 20 months. So that's why the length of required savings is there. Or the savings goal could be different. It could be more limited. Like it's like I said before, look, you know, your goal is for housing, etc., or it could be for a car, etc. It depends. Okay, it all depends. What you need to know is that it's really important for you as a benefits practitioner, if you are talking to an individual about IDEAs, to know upfront the program rules and whether or not the program is either a TANF or AFI funded program, means federal, or if it's a non-federal. And you may be asking yourself, why is that? Why do I need to know whether it is a federal IDEA or not a federal IDEA? Well, very simple. Let's look at how federal IDEAs are treated. Assets accrued in an IDEA established using TANF or AFIA money cannot, under the federal regulations, negatively impact an individual's eligibility for a federal program. Do you hear that? It cannot negatively. That's right in the regulations. The individual's contributions, the matching contributions, and the interest on them cannot be considered as an asset when determining the eligibility or benefit levels for benefits like Social Security, Medicaid, and food stamps, or SNAP, as they call it now. But it still says food stamps in the rules. Is that amazing? So you notice how federal IDEAs are treated, and that's why you need to know, because for their purposes, nothing, the contribution, the matching contribution, and the interest is not going to be considered, okay, as an asset when we're determining the eligibility or the benefit levels. That's an incredibly strong incentive. Now let's look at SSI and just qualified IDEAs. SSI does not count the individual's contributions, matching contributions, and interest as a resource. And SSI also excludes the individual's contribution from their countable earned income. Do you hear that? It excludes the individual's contribution from their countable earned income. And I wonder what that means. That's pretty interesting. Excludes the individual's contribution from their countable earned income. Okay? And I, in fact, am going to give you a polling question on that. And polling question reads, if an individual on SSI works and contributes $50 towards an IDEA, he will be considered to have earned $50 less. Okay? True or false? That's the question. Let me launch the poll. If an individual on SSI works and contributes $50 towards an IDEA, he or she will be considered to have earned $50 less in terms of the calculation of the income. That's a pretty amazing, if the answer is true, that's a very nice thing to happen. If the answer is false, you know, I mean, that's what we might have expected to happen. But I want to see how what people know already, and look second bullet there, and see if you know, what you think the answer would be. And right now, already, we have got 75% of you having voted in 48 seconds. Man, that is good. I love it. I just love when we have this kind of participation. Thank you for being such good participants here, because it's what makes these sessions good. It's when folks are engaged in what is being covered, okay? And when folks have questions, and that's why our winters, I appreciate all your questions. Every one of these questions you've asked is very good. Well, we've got over 80% of the vote in. I am going to close the poll, and I'm going to give you the results. The results are 80% of you said true, and 20% of you said false. And in fact, the 80% are absolutely correct. And that's an amazing benefit. SSI excludes the contribution from the countable earned income. And what I want to do now, actually, is show you in a budgetary example how this works. Let's take an SSI beneficiary, and they're earning $900 per month. They have no other income, and they're not yet participating in. So what do you get? Unearned income is zero. So no problem with unearned income there. But the gross monthly earnings are 900, because the $20 general income exclusion was not used for unearned income. It gets carried over to the earned income, and that leaves 880. Then you take away the earned income exclusion, and that leaves 815. You divide that by 2, and that leaves countable earned income of $407.50. Now, the total countable income is $407.50. We all know that in New York State, if a person is living alone in 2011, that figure is going up by 24 bucks. In 2012, the federal benefit and New York State supplement amounts together is $761, right? So that's total countable income of $407.50 subtracted from the $761, and that leaves us with $353.50 in an SSI check. Now, if we take this one step further, this time the person is earning $900. They have no other unearned income, right? And they contribute $50 a month to a federally funded IDA account. Now, watch what happens here. You have gross monthly earnings of $900, but you have an IDA contribution of $50, and that gets deducted right away, 50 bucks. That leaves gross monthly earnings of $850. Now you take away the 20, you take away the 65, and that leaves 765. Then you divide that by 2, and that leaves 382.50. That's the total countable income, 382.50. Now you subtract that 382.50 from the 761 living alone rate, leaving us with an SSI check of $378.50. Now, let's do ourselves a favor and compare what the SSI amount that the person will be getting with a $50 contribution, that's $378.50, and without the $50 contribution, and let's look at it for a minute, and they were only getting a $353.50 check. So their check is $25 more per month, SSI. And what's going on here is that, if you remember, that's that 50%. So they're getting back a whole half of what they've contributed to the IDA, because it's being excluded as earned income. And that is an incredibly, incredibly positive thing to happen. So it pays for an SSI recipient, because not only are they saving money, but they're getting half of what they're saving back, and they're also going to be getting the matched contribution. And that is an incredibly amazing thing. And again, this is a strategy for you guys to keep in mind as people are thinking about, should I or shouldn't I be involved in an IDA? You want to be able to say to them, here's why you should be. Okay, now let's look at SSI, IDAs, and other work incentives. Okay, and you know we're going to be spending the last 20 minutes to 25 minutes of this webinar on the PAM for achieving self-support. But I want to make sure that we think about, okay, SSI, IDAs, and other work incentives. And the reason I want you to think about it is because, let me just tell you, IDAs and work incentives can really complement each other to support an individual with a disability in increasing their self-sufficiency and, of course, their financial literacy. First, let's look at a PASS. Well, IDA funds that are used for post-secondary education cannot be used to pay for room and board. But guess what? An individual could set aside those funds that they saved up for post-secondary education in a PASS to help them out. And that is pretty amazing when you think about it. Pretty amazing. Additionally, non-federal IDAs could also be put into a PASS. And that, again, is a very, very, very good thing. So I just want you to know that, you know, that's very positive. Next, property essential to self-support. An IDA fund used for business capitalization, okay, will create business assets that are then excluded as a resource under a property essential to self-support. If you're on the farm and you buy a tractor and you've been saving up an IDA for a tractor, business capitalization, now that tractor is going to be excluded as a property essential to self-support. IRWIs and blind work expenses. As an individual increases their financial literacy and their budget, IRWIs and blind work expenses could also provide savings that have otherwise been overlooked. Because if they're on SSDI, you know that IRWIs could be used to bring a person who's making money's earnings from above the SGA to below the SGA. For SSI purposes, an IRWI could be used to get a person back half of whatever they spend on an impairment related work expense. For blind work expenses, it's amazing. We all heard before, and I'll say it to you guys again, that the blind work expenses are absolutely staggeringly good, because it includes things like mandatory pension contributions excluded. It includes meals consumed during work hours. It includes all taxes paid. And so great benefit right away. So, you know, you can use them all in conjunction. Now let's look at how non-federal IDAs are treated by the different public benefits program. Well, look at this right here, right off the bat. Generally, only the assets accrued in an IDA established using TANF or AFIA money cannot, under federal regulations, negatively impact an individual's eligibility for federal programs. And that's what I told you before. But the states themselves decide how non-TANF and non-AFI IDAs are going to impact the state, Medicaid, temporary assistance, which is considered family assistance in New York, and food stamps. So let's see how our state treats them. First, Medicaid, individual development accounts. And this is straight from the Medicaid resource guide on page 307. And look at what it says here, okay? A trust created in the United States by or on behalf of an individual eligible for family assistance and funded through periodic contributions by the establishing individual and matched by or through a qualified entity, which are listed below. So they're going to be excluded as long as it's an organization which meets the definition of not-for-profit under the IRS, okay? So this is very important. And it's exempt from taxation. So if the individual development account has been designed and established by a 501c3, then it will be also excluded for Medicaid purposes. Or if it is a local district, that's the creator, acting in cooperation with an organization described in A with a not-for-profit organization. Okay? So that's very important. But here's the key. Neither the state nor the local district is required to make or match contributions. It would have to be done by the 501c3. Okay? So when are non-federal IDAs excluded? Basically, when they are established by a 501c3 organization, okay? And that's who usually establishes them, okay? They're not usually established by non-501c3 organizations. Now, what about temporary assistance or family assistance? How is that affected? Very important. An individual development account is disregarded for the purpose of determining eligibility or the amount of any assistance or benefit authorized under family assistance for the period during which the person maintains or makes contributions into the account. So as long as the person is making the contributions and they are still involved in the savings, then they are going to be excluded, okay, for budgetary for income purposes. Now, how about for resources? Individual development accounts are exempt as a resource for all public assistance, okay? Family assistance, safety net assistance, food stamps, which of course basically means SNAP programs. So they're excluded as resources. We're okay there. But for income, of course, as long as the is being done. For food stamps, of course, as we said, they're going to be excluded. And look at the way it works here. An individual development account to enable a food stamp household member to save for post-secondary education, first home purchases, or business capitalization is excluded as a resource. Okay? But here's the only time that they're counted. If there is a withdrawal made from the IDA for purposes other than those three items, then any remaining balance will be considered an available resource. Any remaining balance will be considered an available resource. So in other words, if it's not used for these, okay, and then lo and behold, you still have $1,000 in the bank, that's going to be included as part of the resources that, you know, that work, that are counted there. And, you know, look, to me, it's just common sense. I'll be very honest with you. To me, it is just common sense. Now, we just had a question that came up. It says, how does bankruptcy affect any of these programs? And Bernadette, that is a great question. And I would be lying to you if I said I knew how this all works. But I think it all depends on the timing of the bankruptcy, when the person is going through the bankruptcy, and you know, and when the money was there. But I really don't know the answer to that at all. I will try to look it up and get back to you guys, but I'm not sure that it's been treated in the bankruptcy courts yet. But it's a great question, Bernadette. So I wanted just to make sure that we covered that. Okay, now, remember that I said to you, this is not a session where we cover each and everything possible about an individual development account. So you may be asking, okay, so how do I learn more about them? Well, I've got two sites there for you, okay, where you can actually get an idea of, you know, more about IDAs and who you're, how to locate providers, and also how to find both federal and non-federal IDAs, okay? So that to me is incredibly, incredibly important. Someone just says, asked, well, what about HUD housing for non-TANF AFA? AFIDAs. They're treated exactly the same way as federal IDAs. Okay? Basically, only the income based on whatever would be, would count towards it. So no problem. This should be a no problem issue at all. Absolutely no problem issue. Now I'd like to launch our final polling question, because it deals with how much do people know or understand about a plan for achieving self-support. Let me read it to you first. It's as follows. A plan for achieving self-support, a PASS, is an SSI work incentive that can be used to buy an automobile for the convenience of the family. Hear that? For the convenience of the family. True or false? A pass is an SSI work incentive that can be used to buy an automobile for the convenience of the family. True or false? And I'm going to tell you, this was sort of a trick question, and deliberately so. Okay, deliberately so. And I see that we've got, and once I said that, people stopped voting. So don't stop voting. Get back in there and vote again. We're up to 70% of the vote with a 77-23 split. Very interesting. Okay, very interesting. And we're up to 80% of the vote with a 79-21 split. Okay? And that's good because it tells me that, you know, a lot of you need to attend my six-part webinar series, or at the very least, go to nymakesworkpay.org and actually listen to the archived webinars there. There are six of them, and I take you through the every in and out possible about the plan for achieving self-support. As you guys, a lot of you already know, I've actually put together a website called Pass Online, where I talk about passes. I allow people to, I put the application up there. I put in helpful hints and sample answers as drop-down boxes. And lo and behold, people can actually go to it, save it, go back to it, save it. They can have somebody working with them and give them a passcode. And then at the end, just print it as a PDF in final form. So that's really really positive sign. And I'm going to close the poll. Let me share the results. 78% of you said false, and that's the correct answer. And 22% of you said true. Let me hide the results. Let me take you to... SSI work incentive under which a person with a disability can set aside income, either earned, unearned, deemed, or in kind, and or resources to be used to achieve a work, specific work goal. Do you see that? Used to achieve a specific work goal. The reason that the answer was false and not true is that a person cannot put the money on the pass and say, my ultimate goal is to have a car for the convenience of the family. They could get a car, but only if it was going to help them achieve a specific work goal. A car is not a goal. A car for the convenience of the family is not a goal. It's got to be towards a specific work goal. Very important for folks to understand that. And that's the first thing that I always say to people when they actually come to me. I will say to them, okay, so what do you want the savings in a pass to go for? And I often will have people say to me, oh, I want it so that I can actually, and I read this, what I want it for, they'll say to me, so that I can actually, lo and behold, get a car. And I go, but how about work? Well, I don't really want to work, I just need a car. It's like, well, that's not a work goal. And in fact, when you go to passonline.org and you actually look at my pass explanation, it will have a listing of who's a good candidate for a pass and who's not a good candidate for a pass. And one of the folks that will not be a good candidate for a pass is the person who basically just wants the car but doesn't really care about the work goal. And in fact, Social Security has gotten quite wise to what folks want sometimes. And so here's what they've been doing. Social Security will actually say to people, if you want a car, we can lease you a car for now with a big balloon payment. And then if you meet your work goal, the monies that are in the pass will be used to finish paying for the car. But if you don't complete the work goal, then the car goes back to the dealer. And it's what I call carrot and stick. but it actually works. It actually works. Someone just said, when do I conduct the six-part pass training? I just did them this year from March through September. And next year, I will probably not be doing the six-part pass training because our MIG funding has ended and we are just on a no-cost extension. But you can access the six-part pass training on nymakesworkpay.org by going to the resource tab. And there's six items there and you can access them that way. We will probably do one or two sessions on the path next year, but we will not have the funds to do all six again. And it breaks my heart because I think they're really valuable and I think it's always much more fun to listen to them live as we're going along. But you know, it's the way finances are, so we can't do it. Now, what can a pass be established to cover? Well, it can cover the cost of getting an education. It can cover the cost of receiving vocational training to see what the person might be best suited for. It can cover the cost of starting a business. It can cover the cost of purchasing support services. Any of those items, or anything else, as long as it goes towards the specific work goal. And that's the key. Specific work goal. Computers, yes, could be covered. I've actually had the PASS specialists in New York City approve. They have actually approved someone actually going out and getting a haircut, a facial, a manicure, because they were going to a job interview and they still had money in their PASS account, because it was going to help them achieve that work goal, and that person got the job. So incredibly important for folks to keep that in mind. Now we may be saying, so still tell you again, it's a special SSI rule for not counting income or resources that support a work goal. And I've got to tell you, if approved, the PASS can do so many things that are so positive for our clients. And like I said, this is not a PASS training, but let me go through a couple of these for you, because you will get a very good sense right away. I mean, a very good sense right away of how this all works. First, it can help a person retain SSI eligibility, because let's assume that they were making money, and that money that they were making would cause them to have no SSI anymore. Well, lo and behold, if they take the money that would have been counted as earned income towards and against the SSI budget, and we put that money into a PASS, guess what? Lo and behold, right away, they've got that extra SSI money still coming in, and it's like free money because the other money is going into a PASS account. By the same token, it can help them get a larger SSI check because you're excluding some of the money that would have been counted as eligible and counted against them to lower their SSI. It can create SSI eligibility when none existed before. And my favorite comment about this one is to look at the person who's been getting SSDI and they don't have a lot of resources and their SSDI, let's say, is about $900. Out of disregard from $900, that leaves $880. At $880, it's above the SSI level for a person living alone. But if you take that SSDI money of $880 and you put it into the PASS towards a specific work goal, to buy items, towards a work goal, to pay for an education, for a startup business, all of a sudden you've got zero countable income. And now you qualify for a full SSI check of $761 and you've got money in the bank. Or it can be used to establish Medicaid eligibility, or to retain Medicaid eligibility, especially when there's unearned income. that comes into consideration. Again, this is not a training on a plan for achieving self-support. I just want to give you an idea of how it works and how wonderful it can be to have some assets that you then put into a pass that continue to be excluded, okay, that you can use towards a specific work goal down the road. Someone just said, when a person goes to work, this is Lisa, would they still qualify for 1619B? If a person is on SSI and the person loses their eligibility to SSI cash benefits because of earned income, then the person will still qualify for 1619B. Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, that's what the 1619B program is all about. It's exactly what it's all about. Now, here's some resources that I want you to have. First, it's our website. It's nymakeswork.pay. I think it's .org, not .com. I'm pretty sure. So, yes, it is. I'm sure it's .org. Next, there's a financial resources website, yourmoneyny.org, that you should called idaresources.org. There's a National Disability Institute that Elizabeth Jennings is part of that has a wonderful website on assets, IDAs, etc., called www.realeconomicimpact.org. Okay? And then I wanted to, look at this. I'm taking you to the, just so you can see what that website looks like. That's the Assets for Independence resource websites. It talks about success stories, about AFI, how to locate a project near you. So that's wonderful. How to apply for a grant. And I point this out to you because I think it's really important that you get to see that. Now, take you back to our go-to meetings, which should be right over here under, all right, take you back to our resources. And so that's one of the websites that you could look at. Now, what I want to do is take you to our last questions and answers. And there's no questions on the board right now, but I'm going to give you a chance to come up with some questions before I give you some contact information. So contact information, I'm going to give it to you while people think of questions they might still have. Elizabeth Jennings at the National Disability Institute, also affiliated with the Syracuse University Burton Blatt Institute. I've given you her phone number and her email. Myself, affiliated with Cornell University, the Employment and Disability Institute, you've got my phone number and my email. Now, my friends, I've got to be very honest with you. If you call me, the odds of you reaching me are slim because I'm almost never in the office. I'm always traveling. Like the last 2.5 days, I was in Ithaca, okay, for a faculty meeting to do a promo on EDI Online, etc. And then there's Ray Sabula, who would have been with me but for the fact that he's traveling right now. And his email is there and his phone number. And again, you know, if you call him, the odds of reaching him are not real good, but I will tell you that if you do email any of us, Elizabeth, Ray, or myself, we will usually get back to you within 24 hours. Well, since there appear to be no more questions, let me bid you adieu. Let me once again thank you, the participants, for your participation today. And become more independent. You guys, as benefits practitioners, are in an incredible position to do that. And I certainly hope that you do. Take care and have a great day.